had 20 more minutes to prepare, right?
Actually, 22.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. You may begin. May it please the Court, my name is Greg Pivovar. I'm court-appointed counsel for Nicholas Moss. Mr. Moss was shot three times in this case. He was shot in the courtroom. He was shocked when there was a verdict, and he was shot when he was sentenced. I'm going to focus on my second argument first, the destruction of exculpatory evidence. There was a warrant issued in this case. Mr. Moss was in Arizona at the time the warrant was issued. Among the things asked for in the warrant was his cell phone. It was indicated that the victim in this case had indicated that the sexual assault was audio and visually depicted on his cell phone. She believed that to have happened. In so doing, they brought the cell phone into issue. When previous counsel got into this case, he filed a motion on January 4th requesting the cell phone. He wanted to independently, well, not specifically, he filed a general discovery motion. But during the argument for that motion, he indicated he wanted independent testing on that cell phone and to be able to see what exculpatory evidence was in there.
If any.
If any. Well, again, my arguments flow into each other. This one goes into the ineffective assistance of counsel at times because he never specifically in any of his motions set out what exculpatory evidence was in there. It comes out later when some cell phone records that can't be admitted because of, frankly, bad lawyering. He didn't subpoena the people that were necessary to lay foundation for the records. It turns out that if you go through those records that are not admitted, there's tons of telephone calls between he in Arizona and the victim following the incident. Those telephone calls, he claims he tape recorded where she indicated, yeah, I know this didn't happen. I'm going to tell him it didn't happen. Those kinds of things. That's what he says happened. And in his testimony on the motion to dismiss in this case, he brings that out.
If he knew that was there on his phone, why didn't he release his PIN number?
That PIN number thing is, to me, I don't think that's the issue. You may think that's the issue. I don't. They never requested once for his cell phone. The only evidence that there was any request made was the prosecutor's self-serving statement, not on the record and not under oath, that she asked for the PIN, which was refuted in the hearing by both my client saying he never got any requests and the office manager for the attorney involved here saying we never got an email request, we never got a fax request, nobody ever called us and asked us for the PIN.
But Mr. Moss was present at a number of those hearings in which the telephone and the inability to access it was discussed.
It was discussed. The prosecutor was also present in each of those hearings and had the opportunity to say, all we need is the PIN number. She never requested it in open court on five hearings, never once requested it until the phone had been destroyed in a chip-off procedure. So you're saying he had the opportunity, they had the opportunity to ask for it longer. If you will note, she says in a May 14th hearing that the phone had been sent to Lincoln to have this procedure done, this chip-off procedure. So on March 14th, she's saying, we need this procedure done. the phone's already been sent to Lincoln. We can't give it to the defendant and his counsel. In the subsequent hearing in July on the motion to dismiss, the witness for the state that received the phone said he didn't get it until March 20th. So on the March 14th hearing, she said, we sent it to him, and we can't provide it. She didn't ask for the PIN number that day. She made no request. The phone contained the most damaging exculpatory evidence against the state's case. The victim testified on the stand that she received no telephone calls from Mr. Moss. No phone calls. She said, we had some contact, indicating text contact between the two of them. But she said, no phone calls. There were over 4 hours of phone calls in the phone records, which counsel subsequently couldn't get into evidence because he didn't know how. We're in a position where this man was denied his right to confront her because of this procedure, which was a dangerous procedure. The technician or expert at the hearing indicated, we often lose this stuff. It becomes unavailable. We can't access it because of the type of phone that it was, rather than the procedure necessarily. It's a tough phone to get the information from. The defendant made request after request. I don't think this is necessarily a destruction of evidence issue under Youngblood v. Arizona, or Arizona v. Youngblood. I think it's more of a Brady violation. They're aware that the defendant is asking for exculpatory evidence. They do not provide that exculpatory, or the opportunity to get that to that exculpatory evidence. So I don't think it's a bad, the court in the motion to dismiss hearing indicated it's a bad faith issue. I don't know that you even have to get to bad faith if you believe it's a Brady violation. Brady doesn't require bad faith at all.
It requires material evidence?
Material evidence, correct. They were denied the access to the material evidence, which they say was there. The procedure, let's go back to the first thing the prosecutor said when he requested the telephone on January 4th. They're not getting that telephone. And they didn't get it. They were denied access to that telephone because of this procedure. Whoever should have volunteered a PIN number or gave up a PIN number, whichever way you want to go with that, they were still denied access to the most important piece of evidence in this case.
Was there evidence on the phone that was not available just from the records from the phone company, from the carrier?
Oh, obviously, if the entire phone call was tape recorded as he said it was, that he testified, my client testified that he had the ability, he had an app on his phone that he could punch the app and it would record any particular phone conversation he was involved in. That was in the summer hearing, in the July hearing, he testified to that. If that entire phone conversation was in fact recorded, of course there was evidence that was not. I mean, the phone records could have established that her credibility was low because there were in fact 4 hours of phone records involved in this case, and therefore, her credibility would have been severely damaged by that evidence, I think. After she testified, we had not one conversation. Her credibility would have been about zero, in my opinion, because, you know, as most of these cases, it's a he said, she said, and credibility is the big issue in this.
If that tape recording had such exculpatory evidence, doesn't that suggest even more that he should have turned over his PIN number so they could get in the phone? I mean, it's public knowledge. If the state has to try to force its way into a phone, there's a risk you're going to lose the information.
So
it's convenient to later say, oh, yeah, maybe there was incriminating evidence on there, but there was also exculpatory evidence on there, and now we can't get it. It doesn't make sense.
Well, you say it's public knowledge. I'm not so sure it's public knowledge. Until I got into this case, I had no idea that they couldn't access everything they wanted to in a cell phone without the PIN number. I've been in dozens of cases where they have. Okay, so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How far did we take him over? Okay, let's add that to the state's time, please. Good morning, Ms. Klein.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state in this matter. First of all, we don't know what's on the phone. We know what he says is on the phone, but what he says, a lot of things that are demonstrably wrong. First of all, he claimed, for example, he says, well, they took two phones from me. No, they didn't take two phones from him. The U.S. Marshal testified when we snagged him in Reno, he had one phone on him. One phone is what we submitted. The reason he came up with two phones is because he can't read a police submission report, but said the two phones were submitted out of different cases for analysis. One was his, one was not. He sat there like a knob through, I think, five or six hearings wherein people were practically tearing each other's throats out over the phone and the ability to get into it or not to get into it, never once volunteered that there was exculpatory evidence on it until it came about that, until it basically came about that they were saying we're having real trouble getting into this phone, I don't know if we're going to be able to do it. Then all of a sudden there's exculpatory evidence on it. But he still doesn't volunteer, oh, I need desperately this exculpatory evidence. Here's the PIN number. Please don't destroy my phone. Those words never come from his mouth. As a matter of fact, later on in the hearing on the destruction of evidence, the district court just point blank asks him, did you tell your attorney to provide the passcode? And he said, no, I did not. And the court asks him, if he ever told his present attorney that he wanted to give the passcode to the state, and his response was, I never said directly that I wanted to give the passcode to them. I said I wanted to be able to get into the phones with them so that we can access the information I have. Early on when he was trying to get his phone back, I note that he was trying to get his phone back, not the information on it, his phone. The reason he wanted his phone, I think it's an equally reasonable inference, is he wanted to get his phone back because he knew there was not exculpatory evidence on it, but inculpatory evidence on it, and he wanted to wipe that thing so fast it would make your head swim. The state went through the proper procedures to do, to attempt to access the information. I would also note at this point that I don't think that the information has been destroyed. The information resides on the chip. The phone is toast. I mean, the phone is a goner. But whether or not the information that everyone seems to think is critical still exists is a question that's up in the air. It may still be perfectly intact on that chip. It's just that we can't find a way to get into that chip to read it. So we don't know whether the information that's at issue has been destroyed or is still intact. We know we can't access it, and that's really as far as we go on this thing.
Ms. Klein, will you address on the ineffective assistance of counsel, counsel's inability to get the phone records in because they didn't have the proper person to lay the foundation, as it relates to the victim's testimony that there was no phone contact between her and the defendant?
Obviously, he didn't get the phone records in because he didn't have someone there from the cell phone provider to admit those. What those cell phone records would have shown...
Do they show phone calls between him and the defendant and the victim?
I don't know. My recollection is there were a few, but I think she even said that there were a few phone calls between the two of us. I think she was trying to get, I think what she said, she was trying to get some property back or was trying to arrange for something. She said, if she didn't say that there was absolutely no contact between us. She said there were just a few phone calls and I think a couple of texts after that. What the cell phone records would have shown right now is kind of essentially up in the air. For the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, It's, I think, preserved for post-conviction, but basically that's another story for another day. We'll have to await it, the impact of that at some later point in time. Your Honors, I know there were several issues raised in this case. If you have specific questions about the other assignment of errors, I would be happy to address those.
Can you talk about the situation where he was shocked during the course of trial?
Well, the record on that is skimpy, to say the least. What we know is that at some point, while I believe it's the Deputy U.S. Marshal is testifying, all of a sudden the defendant screams out, and from that point, what happened at that point is basically the district court made a record that they assumed that what they keep calling a bandit, which I'm assuming is the stun belt, that the bandit had inadvertently gone off. The deputy in charge said, well, I didn't touch the button. Nobody knew exactly what happened, other than the fact that he had screamed out in court. So apparently they switched it out, and the case proceeded beyond that. There was no objection made, and I don't know what, if anything, the quote-unquote damaging impact would have been. I would think, if anything, it would probably engender sympathy from the jury, because here's this guy just sitting there, and all of a sudden he gets zapped and loud enough that he screams out and probably scares the bejesus out of everyone in court.
He said something about it was his back or
something like that, yeah. Yeah, so.
And there was no request for any instruction to be made to the jury?
Correct.
And no motion for mistrial?
That's correct.
But it was raised at the motion for new trial?
I believe that's right, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, they tried to address it as sort of a plain error type of thing. But what prejudice, if any, there is, would be at this point purely speculative. I think the fact that he apparently did get shot could cut both ways. It could make the jury think he's a terribly dangerous person, or they could just simply, jurors, by and large, have no idea who gets put in a stun belt and why. They may assume that every person is in a stun belt and the thing malfunctioned, and they may feel sorry for him. At this point, it's just purely speculative what impact it had, and because nothing was, no record was made of it otherwise. If there are no further questions, then we would ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here. Case is submitted. We'll keep it under advisement. Thank you both for being here.